Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
We maintain the peace through our strength. Weakness only invites aggression.
Trust but verify.
Well, I've said it before and I'll say it again. America's best days are yet to come.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
This is Reaganism, a podcast dedicated to exploring where the Reagan movement lives today. I'm Roger Zackheim, your host, director of the Ronald Reagan Institute in Washington, D.C.
On this episode of Reaganism, Roger is joined by Paul Ryan, former Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives and a current trustee of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. Speaker Ryan was first elected to Congress in 1999 to represent Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. He later served as then-Governor Mitt Romney's 2012 vice presidential running mate. Roger and Speaker Ryan discussed Reagan's impact on the congressman's dad, the importance of pro-growth and anti-poverty economic policy, and what Speaker Ryan's been up to since leaving Congress. If you're interested in learning more about the Reagan Institute, visit our website at www.reaganinstitute.org, and we hope you enjoy the show.
Speaker Ryan, welcome to the Reaganism Podcast. Very excited to have you here at the Reagan Institute offices in Washington, D.C. You're our trustee of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation Institute, so a double honor to have you here and excited to chat with you today about Reaganism, the legacy, and kind of where it resides today. We're going to date you a little bit here, and by our calculation, you looked younger, by the way. I don't know.
I'm going through a de-aging process right now. Okay. Yeah, that's right.
But our calculations, our in-house mathematician said that you're about 10 years old when President Reagan was sworn in, and when you were kind enough to speak at our opening in September 2018, you really mentioned your dad. It was kind of part of your memory of Reagan. What do you recall?
Yeah. First of all, nice to be with you. Thank you very much for having me, Roger. It is basically my first memory of politics and my first actual involvement or the first time I really paid attention to it. And it was Reagan. It was my dad. I'm Irish Catholic. My dad, Irish Catholic man. We lived on the Rock River in Janesville, Wisconsin. And just downstream from us on the river was Dixon, Illinois. And so to my dad, having this guy who grew up in Dixon, a town like Janesville, make it to the presidency of the United States, an Irish Catholic nonetheless. I mean, he was raised Irish Catholic. He wasn't later in life. Was a big deal to my dad. He so identified with that. More importantly, it was his philosophy. My parents were not big fans of Jimmy Carter, to say the least. My dad was excited about Reagan. He was excited about his rise. And so I just could see the enthusiasm my dad had.
Was he particularly political?
Not really. But the Packers were losing a lot in those days, so there wasn't much to be enthusiastic
about. You had to watch something else on TV.
Gotcha. Yeah, exactly. So I just remember seeing my dad really upset about the Packers, you know, poor performance in those days. And it was just neat to see him get excited about it. You know, I never saw my dad put a bumper sticker ever. We weren't a very political family.
But so he had a Reagan bumper,
had a Reagan
sticker, on the
bumper sticker on the family car, which was just amazing. You know, it was an Oldsmobile, 98 Regency sedan.
We got to get a picture of that. We got to pull that out.
Yeah, my mom had a Chevy Caprice
archives.
Classic, one of those simulated wood grain, you know, panel.
Carpool car.
Station wagons. Yeah, that's right. So the fact that my parents put, you know, these – I've never seen that before. So I really just fell in love with watching Ronald Reagan right at the get-go, and it made me a fan to begin with, and I just started basically paying attention to Ronald Reagan. I remember exactly where I was the moment when I went to St. Mary Catholic School when it was announced that he was shot. And the principal, Sister Evelyn, called over the loudspeaker that this had happened, that they're closing school to send people home.
Wow.
So our school, our little Catholic school, got out for, you know, I can't remember exactly what time of day it was. Rick Ahern's a very close friend of mine who was obviously there for that. He would know all those play-by-play things. He walked me through it once at the Hilton Hotel.
But the shooting office is relevant to having a Speaker of the House here because it's famous that Al Haig forgot the succession.
That's right. Yeah, he kind of did.
He left out the Speaker.
We call it COG, continuity of government.
Yeah, exactly, the COG.
But so there are all these Reagan moments I remember vividly as a kid, and it was basically because of my dad's enthusiasm and excitement about Ronald Reagan.
So that enthusiasm and excitement, I felt it spilled over when you were kind enough as Speaker to inaugurate the Reagan Institute, and you give a fantastic speech. We'll link to it on the podcast notes. But there's one line in there that you had, which I'd love to read to you and get you to kind of unpack a little bit, which is you said, and it was kind of prospective looking, if there was ever a moment when we needed the clarity of President Reagan's vision example, it is now. And here are the words you use. We need to renew, relearn, relitigate the principles he advanced and apply them to the problems of the day. Why is that essential in this moment?
Well, I think, first of all, with the end of the Reagan presidency, and I came out of college in 1992, but in 1989, when the wall came down, you did not have to convince young people in those days the benefits of free market economics, which we call supply side economics at the time, but the pitfalls of socialism. There was just never a debate because millions of young people, same age, were teeming out of Eastern Europe decrying the horrible things that socialism brought about them. So the case between capitalism and socialism was not a hard one in those days. It is now. There's this new, historically ignorant, romantic attachment to socialism among young people these days, which means we have to go back to the basics and relitigate these lessons. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there's a lot of people who aren't paying attention to history.
Right. And we never had to defend it.
That's right.
So kind of the seems to me that it's the product of our success.
It explains
where we are right now.
We rested on our laurels for too long. But then there's also the case that, like Reagan, after Carter brought in Morning of America, City on the Hill, he brought a great sunny disposition, optimism toward freedom. And I think the free world has new stress tests. I think democracy itself is being stress tested internally, but also externally by illiberal governments that have digitized totalitarian regimes. And I think these are new stresses on democracy that present such challenges that you need a Reagan-like attack to this problem. So you need a Reagan-like comprehensive plan of action to champion democracy in the 21st century.
So you get to domestic kind of affinity for kind of some form of socialism. You talk about the democratic backsliding and rise of autocracies. I mean, connect that with the politics today. Why is this such a fertile environment? So on the one hand, you know, you explain why younger people may not have that experience in memory, but our leaders, it is not Morning of America by any stretch. And the division that better than anybody else. Kind of give us a sense of the state of the politics today and how that align, you know, kind of nests with what you've just been describing.
Yeah, the concern I used to always have was that identity politics would one day be practiced successfully by the left and would be proven successful. Because not since sort of when Saul Alinsky wrote about it, had it really been successfully deployed. I think Obama played identity politics pretty successfully with 21st century technology. And that was concern number one. Number two, and even more concerning in my mind as a conservative, is the right plays identity politics now. And identity politics typically is dystopian type politics. It's populism based upon darker emotions, envy, fear, anxiety. That is not Ronald Reagan optimism, inclusion, inspiration. And so the kind of politics that have been proven successful that have an incentive to play in this digital age we're in is identity politics from both the right and the left. And those are, by definition, politics of division. That is not the Reagan optimistic, inclusive kind of politics that I was raised on, that drew me to politics in the first place, that I learned from Jack Kemp specifically, who drew inspiration as a protege of Ronald Reagan. I think Jack saw himself that way. I think a lot of us did.
This politics of division, this identity politics, you said you saw it on the left, you're seeing it on the right, but it translates, and you keep on mentioning digital age, so maybe we can talk about that, but it translates into electoral success.
It does.
It for any other reason.
Correct.
The Reagan approach, some would say, is not a recipe for winning.
I think that's, a lot of people draw that conclusion, and I think right now you would have to say the evidence suggests that, but I see the challenge for, let's just call it Reagan conservatives of this day and age, is to figure out how to make Reaganite politics successful again.
Right.
So the question in my mind, because now I'm not worried about the day-to-day of running Congress, I worry more about sort of the future of the conservative movement so that it can be majoritarian, so that we don't lose the left, which would win by default if we tear ourselves up and cave in. I think we have to figure out how to make the politics of inspiration and inclusion demographically majoritarian and inclusive and appealing. And we just haven't figured that out yet. So how do you have a center-right, classical liberal conservative movement like Reagan did, something that politicians want to pursue because it's the smart thing to do, politically speaking? So how do you get a situation where all the strategists and all the campaign consultants and the people who are ambitious in politics practice Reagan-type politics? We are not there now. We're at identity politics, populism right now. And Reagan was populism. Don't get me wrong. This was a populist movement, but it was a populist movement built upon a solid foundation of accurate, truthful principles with the political upside of bringing people together and unifying people.
Right.
That is what we have to figure out, how to make that successful again.
I mean, it was populist, no doubt, and you had the Reagan Democrat. You know,
That's right.
I mean, there was even a book out which argues that Reagan was a New Deal Democrat through his entire political career. But it seems to me, how much is just personality? It's just kind of, you know, seeking
yeah,
unity,
a lot to that.
Optimism.
Yeah.
Do you believe that we could, with one candidate whose orientation is unifying and positive, can kind of build that coalition together?
I don't know the answer to that. My guess is it's going to take a lot more than that. What Donald Trump has done successfully, to his credit and to the conservative movement's credit, is he's brought the blue-collar worker back into the fold.
Yeah.
It's the same people I represented in Wisconsin. Reagan Democrats are now Trump Democrats, or really Trump Republicans.
Right. They're
probably the most reliable part of the Republican base today. So that is to the good. The challenge is we're losing, as our last midterm elections, a lot of college-educated suburban voters,
right,
which were also a really important part of the Reagan coalition. So what we don't want to do is add one group of voters at the expense of another group of voters. We just want to keep adding. And that's why I believe the ultimate recipe for success in 21st century conservative politics is Reagan-type aspirational inclusive politics. We've just got to figure out in this digital age of identity politics how to make that successful, how to make that something people choose to pursue, which is really not where we are right now.
I want to shift a little bit in a moment to what you were doing to address those different constituencies in the Congress. And you stated publicly there are a number of successes that perhaps don't get the recognition you think it deserves. But you've mentioned maybe four or five times in this brief discussion, in the digital age.
Yeah.
And maybe just take a minute to just unpack what that means and what is so profoundly different about trying to do what you came to Congress to do, this positive, optimistic, unifying, bringing a coalition together, you know, the Janesville, Wisconsin to the suburban Chicago
yeah.
conservatives, that is now made more difficult because of what you keep on referencing, the digital age.
Math and science have made it more difficult. What I mean when I say that is algorithms, mathematical algorithms, and just digital technology has made it easier for people to self-select into cul-de-sacs. It has made it easier to sort of weaponize, and there's a whole cottage industry.
Right,
this
of course.
Stuff.
Yeah.
There's a conservative industrial complex, and the liberals had their own as well, where you have sort of entertainment wings of our parties where great amounts of money can be made on practicing divisive politics. And if you just go on various popular websites, you'll see the algorithms that are basically wired toward what I would call more division-based politics. So it feeds on itself. And I think all of this is built upon the pervasiveness of moral relativism. So you have relativism that is really seeped into society, obviously another generation's worth since Reagan. And you add to that digital technology, you add to that algorithms, and you have a society that is sort of pulling at its seams from itself. And that is why you do need leaders. And I don't know if it's going to be one charismatic leader, but probably mm-hmm. you need a concerted effort to try and resist that and do it in such a way that the algorithmic society we live in, that it makes sense to have unifying politics, that it makes sense to bring people together. It makes sense to reject those things that polarize and divide us and move toward things that unify us and common principles and successful. The way I look at this at the end of the day mm-hmm. is deny the oxygen to identity politics. And the greatest source of oxygen is anxiety, economic anxiety in particular. That's why I think the economic policy that's underway right now, a few things withstanding, is going to help us get over this hump,
so
because we're seeing better economics practice now. And basically, we're practicing Reaganomics. Trade aside, outside of trade, we're basically practicing Reaganomics.
Right. And we'll get to the economics in a second. I just want to pursue this one point here for a second. I mean, you read Reagan, and you've talked about this a lot. I've been reading what you've been saying and writing while you're serving as speaker and then afterwards. A lot about the dignity of the individual.
Yeah.
You know, what we can do to address the anxiety that you just referenced. And it seems to me you connect that with stitching this back together, the seams that are coming apart. You talk about criminal justice response to the opioid crises, small business regulations that you repealed. Just take a minute to talk about those, what I think you referenced as underrated successes.
Yeah.
And connect that to the stitching.
So we had the most productive session of Congress in the last session, the 2017-2018 session. It's the most productive session of Congress since Reagan's first term. We passed over 1,000 bills out of the House, and more than half of those made it into law. That's
a good percentage.
About 1,178, if I'm not thinking off the top of my
right.
head. So we doubled the production of Congress. from its average. And the things like you just described, not opioids, criminal justice reform, but we had a very good poverty agenda that we put in place, which I call a center-right. This is what I do at the American Idea Foundation, my foundation.
Right.
We passed opportunity zones. We passed social impact bonds. We passed this thing called the Evidence Act, which is to use data and analytics evidence to prove the principles of upward mobility actually are effective so you can change the way we approach poverty. This is a center-right, uplifting, Reaganite-type poverty agenda, which we all passed into law this last session of Congress, and now we're deploying those policies.
Which is the legacy of Jack Kemp.
I mean, this is where he really emphasizes
Empower America and things you worked on.
At Empower America on enterprise zones. We call them opportunity zones now, but that's not law. Jack Kemp worked on this idea his entire career. We just put it in place
this
in
is the
2017.
Renewal. It takes some time.
Yeah, it takes time.
Now, of course, there needs to be some – I mean, you talk about the romanticizing of socialism, for example. I mean, what you've just described in terms of poverty and employment and opportunity zones, I mean, this, of course, is what you're doing the American Idea Foundation is to say, hey, the system can work.
And can
work for the demographic right now
that
it feels disenfranchised.
That's right. So I think we're on our road. And I think that the feedstock of this sort of uglier populism was based upon a decade of anxiety. We had a horrible recession. Obama put in place really bad economic policies that didn't do well. You had a wealth effect where, to borrow their phraseology, the wealthier did really well and everybody else didn't. That was basically because of, I would say, loose money from the Fed and a really bad fiscal policy by Obama. Well, Trump came in and we put in place our Better Way agenda, which was this economic plan that we had put together. We ran on it in the 2018 election, and excuse me, in the 2016 election. Put those in place, regulatory relief, tax reform, all these things that we discussed, and it worked. And now you're having massive wage growth. You're having wage growth, particularly from poor and lower middle income workers, exceeding inflation. It's the fastest wage growth rates we've had in over a decade. And so we're beginning to see
impact on kitchen table.
Impact on kitchen table. Now, it's been just a couple of years. So I think we're going to have to have sort of sustainable economic growth in society, wage growth, upper mobility, to really sort of deny the oxygen from the ugly populism we see and build upon a Reagan-like kind of a momentum.
But you believe ultimately it's monetary and fiscal policy that can deliver.
Yeah.
You have to have the programs in place,
That's
the kind of things you're doing in the American Idea Foundation. But those policies
it's the
environment.
The basic foundation is good economic policy. We have – I would quarrel a little bit with the trade agenda. But putting that one aside –
I'll join you on that.
Yeah. Putting that one aside, we have great economic policies in place. It's making a huge difference. It's reigniting upper mobility. But more importantly, it's reigniting people's belief and faith in themselves, their future,
that
the economy, that the system can work.
When you think and hear the word Reaganomics, what is that legacy? What do you think President Reagan's economic legacy kind of means? What does it mean to you?
It's what I was raised on. It's what drew me to politics. It's why I went to college, what I studied in college. I would call it freedom economics, liberty economics. And you have to remember, when Reagan came in, you had stagflation, you had double-digit inflation, you had excessively high unemployment because of terrible economic policies that were practiced. So he brought back in the idea of sound money, which was sound monetary policy. Paul Volcker put the brakes, raised rates. Alan Greenspan continued it. So you had this big fight between economic schools of thought. Let's just call it Milton Friedman versus John Maynard Keynes. It was sort of the Chicago school versus sort of the left-wing economics. I've always thought of Keynesian economics as sort of an excuse for liberals to practice their political philosophy and cover it over with some sort of veneer of economic doctrine. But you had classical liberal economics, Chicago school type economics. You had people like Bob Mundell and Art Laffer and Jude Winiski and George Kilder writing brilliant books at the time describing what supply side pro-growth liberty economics would do. Ronald Reagan didn't run on this in 1976. He ran on this in 1980. My old mentor, Jack Kemp, had, I think, a pretty good role to play in that in working with Ronald Reagan. So did Art Laffer and others, you know, California guys, to get Ronald Reagan to run on this. And then they put Kemp Roth in place, and they put sound money in place, and they put a good regulatory structure in place. And so what Ronald Reagan did, which is kind of happening right now, is he unleashed the creativity of the American people, of the American worker, of small businesses, of business creation and generation. And so you had seven fat years, according, you know, Bob Bartley wrote a great book about this, that really showed the power of what I would call classical liberal economics, which is freedom economics, which is free market economics and free enterprise. Instead of this top-down, heavy-handed, big regulating government spending agenda that the Western world embraced for some time, still does in many cases. And Reagan proved these things that we all sort of instinctively knew to be true as conservatives. He proved it in practice. What I'm excited about the current agenda that we have in place is we're reproving and relitigating that Reagan agenda. The Better Way agenda we ran on in the House in 2016 was basically Reaganomics 2.0 for the moment we are in.
So let's pause there. President Reagan's economic policy, which you've referenced as freedom economics, was based on four policy pillars. It was reduce government spending on domestic programs, reduce taxes for individuals, businesses, and investments, reduce the burden of regulations on business, and then support
sound money,
slower money growth in the economy. Do these four principles, those four pillars, still apply today?
Yeah, they do. We didn't do the reduced domestic spending part. We did do our defense buildup. When you have divided Congress, it's a little challenging sometimes. For me, it's the bane of my existence as Speaker of the House is the 60-vote threshold of the filibuster.
President Reagan regretted at the end of his presidency that he didn't.
It's the same thing with he had the
entitlement
same
spending.
Yeah, that's right. Well, entitlements were such a fraction of what they are now as a proportion of the budget back in those days versus where they are now. But that is the Reagan pillars, and we have basically applied that. We just came out of a great recession. I would say on monetary policy, I would have done it a little bit more differently, but for all practical purposes, we're the world's reserve currency. That's a very important place. And we have lower interest rates and we have, relatively speaking, sound money. I always tell people we're the healthiest looking horse in the glue factory when it comes to monetary policy. I would have done things a little bit differently, but nevertheless, we are coming from the great moderation, this period that Reagan ushered in of sound money that has given us a great American century, second half of the 20th century, and has launched a really good 21st century. Now we have big fiscal challenges with entitlements, but the deregulation and the tax reform, which were put into place in 2017 and 2018, have brought back the kind of economic growth we knew we could have that we really haven't had since the Reagan years.
Reducing burdens, regulations, you know, reduced spending, tax reductions. Why is this relevant to young people? Why does a high school student or a college student need to be concerned about these pillars of what you call freedom economics?
Because it allows you to do what you want to do with your life. It allows you to come out, go to college, get out of college and have a good job in the profession and the career that you choose. That's not been the case the last decade. A lot of people didn't come out of college working in the careers and their chosen fields. They do now. Why? Because we have jobs. We have the lowest unemployment rate in my adult life right now. In my life, excuse me, not since 1969, I was born in 70. Not since 1969 have we had these kinds of unemployment rates. And we had the lowest unemployment rates among Black and Latinos as well. So what we are practicing now are those kinds of economics that we proved. First of all, I think it was harder to pass this agenda in Ronald Reagan's time. He had a Democrat Congress. He was able to work with Tip O'Neill, but he was Kemp Roth. That was a Democrat House that he had to move that through. We had a Republican House and a Republican Senate, albeit a razor-thin majority in the Senate. So I would argue it was a little easier for us to pass our Reagan-like agenda. But the reason it was easier is because we had already proven this was true in Reagan. There were enough memories lasting that if we repeat those economic lessons of the 1980s, we'll probably get the same kinds of results. And what happened? That's what happened. We've repeated those economic lessons, and we're getting those kinds of economic results.
And you mentioned a couple of times in this discussion about the emphasis on poverty and employment. You know, fame that you started out as a wonkish intern in D.C. working at Empower America with Jack Kemp as your mentor, others there, Gene Kirkpatrick and Bill Bennett. I mean, the greats who really advanced a lot of these principles. Tell us a little bit about kind of what you saw then that made this focus, particularly on the dignity of the individual.
Yeah.
Poverty and opportunity that continue to inspire and seems drove you through the Congress and seems to be driving your activity today.
Yeah, well, it came from just my value system and it came from just my faith. But I learned this on the ground in a grassroots sense from Jack Kemp. So came out of college, I worked for Bob Caston, actually, who was a soldier in the Reagan Revolution, a U.S. senator from Wisconsin who came in the 1980 landslide. He lost his election in 1992. So if your boss loses his election, you lose your job. And Jack Kemp was forming a think tank called Empower America, and he called up Bob Cass. He just ran into Bob Cass. He said, I'm looking for somebody young to be my economic staffer. He's like, I got just the
free,
guy.
Free labor.
Yeah, no, no, I was paid. I was an intern for Cass. And then
I got you. Okay.
So then I went on as the economic policy person at Empower America, the brand new think tank that Jack had started up, basically to be the shadow government to the new Clinton administration in those days.
Right.
To work on Reagan economics. And I spent a lot of time with Jack, who became a mentor of mine, running around the country in poor communities, watching him proselytize the benefits of capitalism and entrepreneurship and upper mobility in the least of all places, places that had no Republicans.
Image of him standing on a table, you know, with
we'd go to Cabrini Green and Robert Taylor Holmes, the projects in Chicago. And we would go to all of these places and just watch Jack Kemp, his infectious enthusiasm, preach the power of free market economics and entrepreneurship. It was extremely inspiring. It really, frankly, what I wanted to do with my life is I wanted to go to University of Chicago, get my doctorate in economics, then I wanted to go practice economics. I never thought about being a politician, let alone, you know, running for Congress. So it was Jack that got me into politics.
Thank goodness for that.
Yeah, he's the one who sort of encouraged me to go to run for Congress. He helped, you know, I was 28 years old when I got elected, and Jack was one of those people.
Do Republicans not do enough of what Jack Kemp was doing, getting on the tables and in those neighborhoods that aren't red districts?
Correct. So that's what my foundation is doing.
So this is the American Idea Foundation.
So it's to take and champion center-right poverty economics, poverty programs like Opportunity Zones and Impact Bonds and this new Evidence Act, which will be a vindication of our principles like work and personal responsibility, and to work with members of Congress to make sure that we can take these ideas and these lessons and champion them in the least of all places, in the poorest of the poorest communities in America, so that I think Republicans, it's a nonprofit, but members of Congress, public officials, can go and talk about these principles and these values and these policies and build an inclusive society. So to me, it's Reagan Kemp economics and it's Reagan Kemp politics that what we are hoping to do is help get a new generation of young political leaders to take that kind of conservatism, that kind of unifying, inclusive, optimistic conservatism in the parts of America that don't even vote Republican, don't know Republicans, don't talk Republicans, don't even think about Republicans. And that to me is fertile ground for a conservative movement that should be worthy of the majority of the support of this country.
Getting interest and partnerships with members of Congress for this? I mean, how's it coming along?
Yeah, yeah. I just launched it this last year. Yeah. Our first field outing is going to be in Indianapolis. Hmm. Todd Young, great senator. He used to be a House member and a member of the Ways and Means Committee.
And member of the House Armed Services Committee before you stole him on the Ways and Means Committee.
I stole him over the Ways and Means because he's a great guy. And he authored social impact bonds. So there's some poverty policies, center-right poverty policies.
So tell me more about the social impact
bond that we put in place. So basically, I'll do the Cliff Notes version. It's a private sector solution where if you see a problem you want to solve, let's just say homelessness in Indianapolis, and you will float a bond to pay for this innovative private sector design solution that is pre-measured as to what success will look like. And if those metrics of success are met, then the bond pays off in a tax-free way. So you get private sector investment into a private mission to solve a public good. And if it works, then it pays off. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
Right, right.
And there's a risk in that, but that's the whole idea.
And this was a Todd Young
signature. It's a Todd Young initiative. He got the idea actually from the Brits. The Brits, a great Tory named Ian Duncan Smith, put this in place in the Tory government, and it's pretty successful. So what we're trying to do is say the war on poverty is not just a government function. It's not just spend more money, get people hooked up on the government programs. It's let's do things that are innovative, that integrates the poor, that brings the private sector to bear to solve these problems and to get some real solutions. So we're going to be doing some field things with the Indiana delegation, So things like that are things what we're doing is to make sure. I spent 4 years before I was speaker running around the country with Bob Woodson from the Center for Neighborhood Enterprise, just learning and listening from advocates in the poor communities about the struggles and the problems they had, and then getting extremely inspired by people who are doing incredible good things. And that sort of inspired this agenda that we put in place and actually passed into law in Congress in the last session.
You're describing stuff at the federal level.
Yeah.
You've said this. Ben Sasse essentially wrote a book making this argument that so much of what we need to do for these communities and what the country needs is actually not a government solution. You're kind of hinting at that or referencing that, I should say, with this particular case of the bonds. But more broadly speaking, how are we too reliant? Do we look too much to government?
We do.
And kind of what's your
and so this agenda that I've described is basically to re-leverage the private sector and private charity and private individuals to get back into the game of fighting poverty more successfully. The war on poverty was obviously a huge effort. Well-intended as it was, it barely moved the needle on poverty.
Right.
And it reinforced this notion in society that this is government's responsibility. You, private citizen, don't worry about it. Pay your taxes. Government will take care of it. And we'll measure success based on how much money we're spending and how many programs we've created and how many people are on those programs. Our whole argument here with this approach, this Reagan-Kemp type approach that we champion at the American Idea Foundation, is let's measure success based on results and outcomes. Are we getting people fully out of poverty? And let's stop segregating the poor, making this just government's responsibility, and make it our own individual personal responsibilities in each of our communities. And let's embrace ideas and policies that can breathe life into that. And that is exactly what we're trying to do.
I'm going to pivot now to, you referenced earlier when you were kind of setting up this dynamic and kind of why we're at this moment where there's so much division and in particular kind of questioning the system, our republic, you know, the democratic system. And part of it is domestic and internal factors, which we spent some time on. But the other piece of this is kind of the rise of the digital age and how it's being exploited and leveraged by autocracies. You're doing a lot of work. And when you were a speaker, you highlighted real concerns about the Chinese Communist Party. We did a poll at the Reagan Institute, the Reagan National Defense Survey we do annually. And for 2 years now, we've asked the question, what is American people's views on different countries? And for China, we've mentioned this here before in the podcast, 60% or roughly just below 60% view China as an adversary or an enemy, which means that nearly 40% of Americans mm-hmm. view China, and this is what the other option is, as somewhat of a friend or an ally or a full-fledged friend and ally. You're back in Wisconsin, not in Washington, D.C. How do you make the argument that to be concerned about China?
I think the argument I make is China, with its strategy, is trying to displace and replace democracy. And they have some pretty good advantages going for them. First of all, centralized decision making is one thing. That's I'm not something I admire. It's something I just see and can respect in certain respects because
God, it would be nice as Speaker of the House to have that. Yeah,
right. So, but they're doing this with 21st century digital technology. And so, what that means is, I think you're going to see China work with its One Belt One Road strategy and its advancements in technology to equip fellow non-democracies, fellow autocracies, and give them the tools they need to have these sort of digital tyrannical dictatorships versus the free world. And so this is, of all, a Reagan moment. This is one. America needs to lead the free world in standing up for freedom and standing up for classical liberal values and standing up for individual freedom. And so you have a real stress test on democracy. That's the polarization from within, but the big stress test is being attacked from outside from these illiberal regimes, namely China. Russia meddles with bots and all the rest, mm-hmm. but Russia in this whole scheme of things is kind of a bit player. It is China and the China model that is to equip all these other non-democracies with the tools that they will need to have hyper-surveillance states and be able to keep their people down and really threaten the free world.
Do we make a mistake for, you know, the bipartisan approach to China? Bush and Clinton, and then Obama, where we basically said, you know what, we're gonna try to get them to embrace our economic system, and then let them off the hook for the very things you're describing right now, the political system.
This
is a big debate here right
I've
now.
I've given a lot of thought to this. It's probably the one vote I probably regret. I mean,
there is the one vote you regret.
The WTO vote in World Trade Organization, and I think it was 2001. I was like a second termer then.
That was your job on Ways and Means back in the day, right?
Yeah, right.
To vote for WTO deals.
Yeah. You vote for trade deals.
You may not remember this, but one of the first times we met, I was staffing Duncan Hunter Sr., who was not a free trader.
You
must have gotten the short straw because your job was trying to convince him to vote for a WTO. I could have told you beforehand that you could have saved time. I was not going to ask
him. He's the one who took the sledgehammer to the TV set on the steps of the Capitol to protest the Japanese.
Yeah, a lot of great moments about that. Yeah.
I know Duncan pretty well.
But the China vote.
The thinking at the time was, let's give them access to the WTO because they'll sign up to play by these rules, and then they can grow and develop and open up freedom. And freedom, you know, it's like a lot of people who talk about Cuba in certain ways.
Sure.
That, you know, if they become economically free, then they'll demand political freedoms. And that was our thinking. It was probably rosy optimism at the time, and that was what our thinking was.
And we had skin in the game. They held a lot of dollars.
So that was clearly not what happened and took place. That's why I say, with respect to the president, I didn't agree with his trade agenda except for China. That's the fight that I always thought he should have picked, and he's the right guy to pick.
Even 232?
And no, I wouldn't have done 232. Okay. Yeah, I would have done, but the 232.
Sorry, nerding out right now on a particular
tariff. Absolutely
did
not support 232.
Yes. But in terms of taking on China.
But as far as taking on China, taking on all of the things that they do, and we could spend an entire podcast on that. The point is, it needed to happen, better late than never, and the president is right to do it. But my biggest concern going forward is the threat to free enterprise in the world, in the 21st century digital age, where you can have these sort of hyper-surveillance states that mm-hmm. can do an amazing job of China equipping them with the tools they need to suppress freedom. There is only one indispensable country in the world that can stand up against them, and that's the United States of America. And that's why our alliances, that's why our allegiances, that's why all the free countries need to be led by America in a unified way to take on this challenge and this threat on the behalf of freedom and free people around the world.
And you say that with the backdrop of a picture of President Reagan walking with Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and Camp David in terms of, obviously at that time, working with each other to defeat the challenge of the day with the Soviet Union.
Correct.
You're uniquely positioned to focus on this aspect, and then what you're saying is the most fundamental, most important aspect of this competition with China, because the Chinese, and they say this about Xi, but other people on this podcast say that, and he studies Stalin, and they study what the Soviet Union, in their judgment, did wrong. And
they
basically decided, hey, they lost the innovation race.
That's right.
And so much of what you have always spoken about, but emphasized now in the context of China discussions, is the need for America to lead on innovation. Tell us why you think we can win, where we're at, why you think we can win. Is there and kind of hope, reason to be optimistic?
It is because we have the one thing that they don't have. We have freedom. And freedom will always, at the end of the day, prevail, in my opinion, because free people are creative people. Free people are ingenious people. It's always going to work better than some radical form of collectivism at the end of the day. But that end of the day could be a while, because right now, I think they're running laps on us on 5G technology. They're running laps on trying to get the rest of the world to sign up.
I hear
on
Mike Gallagher screaming from Wisconsin.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
One of my best recruits in Congress.
Except for the fact that he did a PhD in President Eisenhower, not President Reagan. We're big fans.
Yeah. So right now, they've got, because of their massive subsidies, they've got the best game in town with respect to 5G. It's cheaper and better. State-owned enterprises can do this. So Huawei can deploy 5G, get the rest of the world hooked up to it. And if they keep this a hardware game where your cell tower has to be one of five companies, in this case Huawei, mm-hmm. then you're stuck with 5G and their 5G for the foreseeable future, for probably a decade. The fight to me is to push what I call this, what is called this O-RAN initiative, which is—
What's that word?
O-RAN. It's an acronym. Don't ask me what it stands for. O-R-A-N. What it basically means is we've got to go from a hardware battle to a software battle. You have to commoditize the hardware, the physical hardware that is on distributing 5G technology, which is this sort of black box Huawei coded system where Huawei can, and the Chinese Communist Party basically can use cyber to basically hack everybody mm-hmm. for surveillance states or whatever. You have to white box, commoditize the hardware and go with the software fight. So it's the software on top of the hardware, whereas where all the key proprietary designs occur. And that is a battle the Western world can win. That is a battle, a software competition the Western world can win. And by the way, it's better and it's cheaper and it means more providers and it means more competition and more choices for people to have 5G. So our argument around the world has been, don't do Huawei 5G, Chinese 5G, because they'll be able to steal your stuff. And that's compelling, but we're telling countries, even though it's cheaper, even though it's right now better, don't do it. It's a pretty hard argument to make. I think we now have the ability to make that argument and say, oh, and something better is coming. There's going to be an alternative that is far better for you in the long run, because you won't be captive by a monopoly. You'll have plenty of choices among software providers that will be bigger, better, and cheaper in the long run for you. and for your economy and for your citizens and for your national security. So to me, that's a big challenge that we can win.
We've gone from Jack Kemp to 5G and Huawei, a conversation you can only have with Speaker Paul Ryan. Before we let you go, lightning round, favorite Reagan book, quote, you want to share with us?
Best book is Steve Hayward, Age of Reagan, but the one that really had the biggest impact was Peggy's book. I was young at the time when I read it, what I saw at the Revolution.
Yeah.
It just really great moved book. Me at the time. It's so well written. Best quote, it's got to be the Brandenburg Gates. It's just got to be the tear down this wall. I can't think of another better quote. As a limited government guy, government isn't the present problem. Government is the problem.
Right.
You know, I love that quote, but it's just got to be Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. It's got to be the best quote, in my opinion.
Apropos for, we're just on the end of the 30th anniversary of the fall of the wall. Right. So one certainly on our minds and one that every freedom-loving person remembers. Speaker Paul Ryan, thank you so much for joining the Reaganism podcast. We look forward to having you back on in the not-too-distant future.
All right. Thank you, Roger.